This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We all wish we had better powers of recollection. We've all experienced the momentary panic of forgetting where we dropped our keys or our reading glasses or having a thought, a word, or a name of a concept just out of reach.
But what if something could make you remember something your mind had already forgotten? Local researchers attempted to do just that in a recent experiment documented in a new study released yesterday.
Brad Postal is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW-Madison and the senior author of the study. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and started by explaining how our brains store memories.
One of the things that we've learned over the past several years is that there are many different kinds of memory. But assuming that you mean long-term memory that we typically think about, like my memory for my mother's middle name or my memory for my phone number, that information is stored in patterns of connections between neurons. Those connections are called synapses. And a synapse can be strengthened or weakened as a result of experience. And we think that memories, in effect, are networks of connections between neurons where the connections at synapses have been sculpted in an exquisitely precise way to encode the information that we will later retrieve and think of as a memory.
So how does our long-term memory compare to what your study really looked at, these working memories?
Right. So long-term memory, as far as we know, has an infinite storage capacity. It has never been discovered that someone literally had so much information in their memory that they couldn't fit one more thing. I don't think that can happen. Working memory, on the other hand, has a very constrained capacity of about, depending on the kind of information, if it's verbal information or verbalizable information, like the numbers of a telephone, for example, a telephone number, we can remember on the order of 7 to 9 items. If it's visual information, like shapes or faces, we can hold in working memory more like 3 or 4 items.
Hmm. So when we say remembering something, when I use the term remembering something, what does that actually look like in our brains when we're talking about working memories versus long-term memories?
Yeah. Well, I think it doesn't look different. So remembering something means retrieving information that's stored in your brain. But if we go back to the example of your mother's middle name, for example, presumably before you called me 5 minutes ago, you weren't thinking of your mother's middle name. Presumably you are right now because I just mentioned it. And so that information was in what I would call a latent state. It was in your brain, but it wasn't active. You weren't thinking about it, and it wasn't physiologically active. When you're thinking about it, you have networks in your brain that represent the sound of your mother's middle name. There are areas of your brain that represent what the shape of the letters of the alphabet are that make up your mother's middle name. You have areas of your brain that correspond to the emotions that you feel when you think about your mother, and those are all activated at the same time in concert. And the activation of that corresponds to your having retrieved the memory of your mother's middle name. Now, working memory reflects the fact that if I didn't know your mother's middle name, let's say it was Edith. I'm just making that up.
It's Gay, actually.
Gay, okay. Well, so I didn't know what your mother's middle name was. And if you gave me a list of common middle names. So if you gave me Gay, Edith, Ross, pretty soon I would no longer be able to keep track of, did you say Edith before or after Gay? Was it Edith or was it Emily? So my ability to keep everything in the forefront of my mind, as it were, to have it accessible so that I could use it, for example, to read back to you, to recite back to you the list of names, That's a very limited capacity, and that's what we call working memory.
So let's look at this actual study. What was your hypothesis going into it?
Right. So we know that you can hold, let's say, three or four items simultaneously. And one recent development with neuroimaging studies is that there are what we call information-based analysis techniques that, in effect, let us read your mind, read your brain in a primitive sense. So if I show you a picture of a face and a picture of a series of letters that make up a pronounceable word and a pattern of dots that are moving in a certain direction, we can measure activity in your brain and learn how those patterns are distinctive from each other, so that if somebody then were to say, okay, I'm showing the research subject a picture of one of those three things, but I'm not going to tell you what it is, we would be able to, with a high degree of reliability, say, oh, she's looking at a picture of a face, or she's looking at a word, or she's looking at moving dots. So we have been able to track the real-time storage of three visual items. So our common sense tells us, and laboratory studies tell us, that we can hold multiple items in an active state. The particular study that we did, however, was one where we gave the subject two items to remember, and then after the items were no longer presented, and so two items were in memory, we told the subject, we're going to test your memory for item number one first. Now, they weren't supposed to forget item number two, because after we tested their memory for item number one, there was a 50% chance that then we would test their memory for item number two. So they had to hold it in memory, but item number one was prioritized because that was going to be tested first.
And these items are pictures of people or words or what have you.
Exactly. They were drawn from those three categories that I mentioned. So the direction of moving dots. And so if the dots are moving, let's say, in the 9 o'clock direction on the clock, and then 5 seconds later, I show you a patch of dots that are moving in the 8:30 direction, you would say, no, that doesn't match because it's not identical to what you had just seen. And similarly, if I show you a face during the test phase, you have to say yes or no, is this an exact match of the face that I just saw? So we do that with those three categories, with motion, with faces, and with words. The interesting thing to us is that in this situation where you have two items in memory, but you know that only one of them is going to be tested within the next few seconds, the evidence of an active representation of the unprioritized item, the item that I've called number two, disappears. And so it's as though you forgot about it, even though if a few seconds later we say, okay, now get ready for a test about item number two, we can see in your brain activity, it pops right back up into an active state.
And this is what in the study you're calling an attended memory item and an unattended memory item.
Precisely, yeah. So both items are in memory, but only one is currently prioritized in your focus of attention.
Now, if I'm getting this right, in the study you said a targeted pulse of transcranial magnetic stimulation, which to me sounds like zapping someone's brain with a magnet, which I don't know if that's quite right, but that restored someone's memory.
What it did was it transiently brought back into an active state that unattended memory item. So remember I told you that the evidence for an active trace of the item that was still in memory but not currently the focus of attention had disappeared. And the pulse of TMS, of transcranial magnetic stimulation, had the effect of briefly bringing back an active trace of that unattended memory item.
How does it do that?
Yeah. Well, we have ideas about how it does that. We aren't yet in a position where we can prove how it happens. But the idea is something like this. We talked about the fact at the beginning of this interview that a memory consists of a specific pattern of weighted connection between neurons. So different synapses have different strengths, which means different strengths of connections between different areas of your brain that represent, say, your emotional memories of your mother and what your mother looked like and so forth. we think that memory retrieval, in effect, is the reactivation of those different areas of your brain that all together in concert correspond to the memory of your mother's middle name. And in effect, the way that you're able to retrieve that information is that the specific patterns of different strengths of synapses, in effect, guide the neural activity, the neural activation, into just the right pattern so that just the right neurons get goosed and therefore just the right pattern of activity is produced.
How did the participants in this study describe the kind of feeling of a memory being retrieved?
Well, they don't actually know that it's happening. So they feel this this crack on their scalp, which is kind of like if you had let's say somebody was holding a cutting board against your head and they gently tapped it with a spoon. That's roughly what it would feel like on your scalp. So they're aware of that, and they're aware that they're doing the experiment. They're not aware of the fact that this information was temporarily activated, but we set up our experiment in such a way that we could determine whether it was in fact activated by how subjects responded on the memory test. So in effect, when we delivered a pulse of TMS, it was as though we fooled the subject into thinking that the unattended memory item was the attended memory item.
So what are the implications of this study?
Right. So to get back to your earlier question, the thing about the TMS that makes it exciting is that instead of you spontaneously, volitionally choosing to retrieve a memory, we think that what we're doing is, in effect, artificially retrieving a memory by delivering this pulse of activity to the right part of your brain. And that activity gets channeled through these weighted patterns of synapses and activates all the right neurons, and the memory comes back. And so in principle, if we get a better handle on precisely how this works, if we can predict that memory A but not memory B or memory C might be reactivated with a certain pattern of pulses, if we're able to do it in such a way that subjects do become aware of the memories that we activated. So at this point, they're not aware of it. We alter their behavior, thereby demonstrating that we did activate it, but we don't actually bring it back into their awareness. If we figure out how to do that, then in principle, you could imagine treatment for different types of psychiatric disease. So depression is associated with rumination, where the patients pathologically think about negative things and are unable to sort of break out of that pattern of negative thinking. Patients with schizophrenia sometimes will experience hallucinations, which is, in effect, paying attention to internal noise inside your head instead of paying attention to the outside world. So if these psychiatric diseases are, in fact, associated with difficulty controlling what one thinks about, difficulty controlling attention to different thoughts that are zooming around in your head, then maybe this would point the way towards an approach whereby we could help people to regain control over what they choose to think about at any given moment in time.
It sounds like something out of Eternal Sunshine for the Spotless Mind.
Yeah, I would have to revisit the movie to know if the analogy is exact. But, it's exciting for us. For me, I've been really interested in consciousness for a long time. You know, what is the combination of electrical and chemical interactions that give rise to this feeling that both you and I are experiencing right now of being a person and sitting in a radio studio and seeing a microphone and so forth, you know, the experience itself? And that's a really hard question to study scientifically. It's easier to study things like how do people remember a face for a few seconds. But when you think about it, if I'm studying how do you remember a face versus a word, part of what I'm doing is studying what the subject is holding in her conscious awareness during those couple of seconds that I'm asking her to remember a particular face. And so this experiment, in a way, I think is getting us closer to those really deep questions about what gives rise to this incredible experience that is what makes us human.
Brad, thank you so much for joining me here on Lake Effect, and thanks for sharing your work.
Oh, it was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Brad Postal is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW-Madison, and he's the senior author of the study, Reactivation of Latent Working Memories with Transcranial Magnetic Stimulation.
The study is the subject of an article in the journal Science. Postal spoke with Joy Powers. For more information on the study, you can head to wuwm.com.